We're discussing the consequences of a closely contested election this hour of the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In light of the president's tweets of a rigged election, fraudulent mail-in ballots, a deep state plot, and our nation rocked by a pandemic and its fallout, and protests over systemic racism, the question is, are we headed toward a constitutional crisis if Election Day is chaotic? Is our system of government prepared for what could happen in a scenario where there is a rocky transition of power? How much faith do you have in free and fair elections? It's 800-642-1234. Lawrence Douglas is a law professor at Amherst College in Massachusetts. He's the author of 7 books. His new one is called Will He Go? Trump and the Looming Election Meltdown in 2020. Lawrence, welcome to the Ideas Network.
My pleasure to be with you. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, you know this. You're talking with folks in a very swing state. And in our April primary, we were the only state to go forward with an in-person election. It came down to a Supreme Court, state Supreme Court ruling at the 11th hour. In cities like Milwaukee, lines of masked voters stretched for blocks. Is this scene setting for November and your fears of election chaos?
Well, I mean, I guess one thing that we can hope is that the experience from April could, alert election officials to the kind of things that need to be done in order to avoid these scenes again in November. But certainly, I think if you look at across the country, yes, we can expect that this is going to be a very unusual and potentially disorderly and, potentially chaotic election.
Well, in our April primary, about 23,000 mail-in ballots were rejected in our state, which is nearly equivalent to President Trump's 2016 margin of victory. How do you see mail-in voting processes affecting how you view Election Day and election results?
Well, I think one of the things that we've obviously seen, Trump engaging in these attacks on the integrity of mail-in ballots. And one question that your listeners might be asking is why is he so vehemently attacking mail-ins and claiming that they're going to be infected by fraud? And there was a poll that was released, I think, on August 26th that indicated that 20% of Trump's voters are likely to vote by mail-in ballot, whereas about 60% of Biden voters are going to vote by mail-in ballot. And I think that tells you right there what Trump's strategy is. He's basically trying to discredit votes that are going to break for Biden.
Are you concerned about the massive shift to mail-in voting and how the U.S. Postal Service is now involved in carrying out that process?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things that we've seen, I mean, you mentioned the figures in Wisconsin about the number of mail-in ballots that were disqualified. I think during this primary season across the United States, in about 24 states, about 530,000 mail-in ballots were disqualified. And one of the reasons for disqualifying them is for tardy arrival time at state official headquarters. And we've seen that the president has been willing to weaponize the USPS as a device for trying to delay or basically frustrate the timely submission of these mail-in ballots. And especially when you're talking about, the potential of slim margins in a handful of swing states, such as your own or Michigan or Pennsylvania, then this weaponization of the USPS could really have a material effect on the outcome of the election.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Lawrence Douglas, the author of the new book, Will He Go? Trump and the Looming Election Meltdown in 2020. We're discussing Election Day scenarios and what Lawrence has been investigating in his book. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Andy now, joining us from Manitowoc. Hi, Andy. What is your question?
Yes, I was wondering if your guest could speak to what we've learned from a disruption of transfer of power to presidency from that which the Obama administration did when President Trump was coming into power.
Andy, thanks. Lawrence, go ahead.
I mean, I think that was a relatively smooth transition of power. I think it's pretty clear that the Obama administration made a very strong effort to prepare the incoming administration for a smooth transition. I mean, a peaceful transition of power has been a staple of American politics for American presidential politics in particular for, 230 years. And certainly, President Obama made clear that he was very grateful to George W. Bush. Obama made it clear that Bush also smoothed the transition to the new Obama administration through, various preparation techniques that had been put in place. So it's never really been a problem in this country.
Well, and why do you think it hasn't been a problem? Why do you think the incumbent presidents in the U.S. have been willing to step aside, step down when they are defeated? Because you ask this question, why would any incumbent leader ever accept electoral defeat?
Yes, exactly. I mean, one of the things we see is that in nations that are transitioning, let's say from authoritarianism to democracy, it's very often once these energetic new democratic presidents take office, suddenly having a second election to keep them in office becomes less attractive to them because now they're in office, and what's the purpose of holding an election when you can just might be ousted? And I think the simple answer is that in our system, the leaders, our leaders have they have absorbed the norms of constitutional governance. And those norms basically tell the incumbent that that the system is more important than their own ultimate political fortunes. And that's what any kind of democratic system relies upon. It ultimately relies on its leaders having absorbed the rules of the game. And I think one of the things that we've seen over the last 3.5 years is that Trump simply hasn't really absorbed the norms of a constitutional democracy. In fact, far from it, I think he's really pretty aggressively rejected them. And more surprisingly still, he really hasn't had to pay a political price for his rejection of these basic norms.
How worried are you that President Trump would stay in office if he loses the election?
Well, I guess it depends on what you mean by staying in office. I mean, I don't particularly imagine Trump barricading himself in the Oval Office come January 21st if Joe Biden has already been inaugurated President of the United States the day before. What I really worry about is the period from November 3rd when we go to the polls and January 20th when, according to the Constitution, Trump's term of office officially ends. And the kind of chaos that he can create in that period, challenging a loss that turns, let's say, on relatively narrow margins of mail-in ballots in a handful of swing states. In that situation, I really think things could go very, very sideways this fall.
Because it would take time in the courts, how do you see that playing out?
Well, I think one thing that we've already seen, and I don't think this is particularly speculative, I have to say. It's almost as if Trump has been, pretty transparent in his messaging. And I think what Trump would try to do, I think he realizes that his best chance of winning this fall is to have a lead on November 3rd itself. And again, that's not unlikely given the statistics that I mentioned earlier, the fact that only a small percentage of his voters are going to be using mail-in ballots, whereas a very substantial percentage of Biden voters will be using mail-in ballots. And recall the mail-in ballots, we're not going to know the results of these mail-in ballots until days or even weeks after November 3rd. And so my concern is that he would try to leverage a lead on November 3rd into an indication that he's been reelected.
Legal scholar Lawrence Douglas's new book is called Will He Go? We're discussing what happens if President Trump does not concede the election. We'll be back to talk more in just a moment on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about what happens if the presidential election comes and goes without an accepted result. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Here's President Trump at a rally in Nevada over the weekend.
And 52 days from now, we're going to win Nevada. And we're going to win 4 more years in the White House. And then after that, we'll negotiate, right? Because we're probably, based on the way we were treated, we're probably entitled to another 4 after that.
Are you worried that a close election will be contested in the courts? Will Americans accept the results of the election no matter who wins? 800-642-1234. Amherst College Law Professor Lawrence Douglas is our guide, and his new book is called Will He Go? Let's take another call now. Jimmy is joining us from Valley Junction. Hi, Jimmy.
Morning.
Good morning.
I think part of the issue is there's so many political appointees now, and I think, I'm not sure of the number, but I thought it was around 5,000, that there's such a big upheaval between administrations. If you eliminated a lot of these political positions and turned them into career employees that are civil servants, you'd have less disruption and less whipsawing back and forth with policy.
Jimmy, thank you for that. Lawrence, what do you make of political appointees? Are they rampant, and how would that impact our electoral system?
Well, I mean, I think one of the things that we've seen, obviously, is the way in which Trump has kind of used his political appointees really as a way of installing loyalists. Now, again, a lot of presidents obviously want to have their political appointees supportive of their politics. But I think in the case of Trump, it's really gone a lot further than that. It really looks like he tries to install people in power who are basically have a dedication not so much to his political ambitions, but to him as a person. And I think that has been very kind of unfortunate to the way their government has functioned over the last few years. And, you know, I don't really think the fact that we do rely on a very large percentage of political appointees in the United States is really the reason why we're having a concern about this election. I think, unfortunately, a lot of it has to do with the particular character of the present incumbent of the White House.
Let's bring in Mary now in Pewaukee. Hi, Mary. What are your thoughts on this?
My thoughts are, I have heard that the Electoral College, well, I think as we know from 4 years ago, is antiquated, and why hasn't something been done about it within Congress or the Senate? I'm not sure exactly. But what are your thoughts on that? As we know, 4 years ago, Hillary won the popular vote, and obviously she is not the president. So what can we do about it, and what has been done, if anything?
Mary, thanks. President Trump lost the popular vote in 2016 by almost 3 million votes, but won the presidency. What do you see, Lawrence, about our Electoral College?
Well, I certainly agree with the caller that we have an anachronistic and arguably dysfunctional method of electing the president. You know, we went the entire 20th century without having the Electoral College produce a winner who had lost the popular vote. But now in the 21st century, let's recall it's already happened twice. It happened in year 2000 when Al Gore beat George W. Bush by more than 500,000 votes nationally, and again in 2016. And I think we really wouldn't be worrying a lot about what's happening this fall if all we were relying on was the national popular vote, because it seems that Biden will win a rather decisive popular vote victory over Trump this coming fall. In terms of getting rid of the Electoral College, unfortunately, that's a much trickier thing. The Electoral College is part of the U.S. Constitution, and as much as we love our Constitution, if there's one thing as dysfunctional in the Constitution as the Electoral College itself, it's the method of amending the Constitution. Our Constitution is exceptionally difficult to amend, and abolishing the Electoral College would, of course, require a constitutional amendment. Now, there are various efforts. There's this pact among various states to try to award their Electoral College votes, not on the basis of the statewide winner, but on the basis of the national popular vote winner. And states representing 196 Electoral College votes have signed on to that pact. And you need, as you recall, 270 Electoral College votes in order to win the presidency. So there is a kind of effort to make an end run around the Electoral College, which I think is a very, you know, attractive thing to do. And I hope in the coming years we will find a way to, in a sense, make an end run around the Electoral College, because, alas, it's not going to be abolished through constitutional amendment.
If you're just joining us, we have Lawrence Douglas, who is a law professor, legal scholar at Amherst College. We're discussing what Election Day results could look like and whether it would trigger a constitutional crisis. With your thoughts as well, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Trish joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Trish. What are your thoughts?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My thoughts are, Trump is really good at as an example that a lie repeated will be believed. And isn't there some kind of concern that this book might be setting a script for him, and that it will be put out kind of as an assumed close, therefore making it easier for him to follow that path?
Lawrence, what do you say to Trish?
Well, I have to say, Trish is not the first person to mention this to me. Other people have said, well, do you worry that you're actually supplying Trump with a blueprint to engage in an act of electoral defiance? And much as that kind of flatters me in a certain respect, I think I really I'm chasing after the phenomenon. I don't think I'm kind of creating it. And I think Trump and Trump's advisors and his legal teams, I think they really have a pretty good idea of what they can do for creating a electoral mess without my telling them how to do so. So I think maybe I'll just kind of leave it at that.
Lawrence, another scenario you imagine is what you call the blue shift. President Trump could be leading in some states on election night, but as the absentee, the mail-in ballots continue to come in, the results swing in Biden's favor, and this possibility has gotten more and more traction. Can you tell us how you see this blue shift playing out?
Right. So, Kate, and this was, again, this was a little bit of, you know, something I was just kind of gaming out in the book when I wrote it. And it now seems to be exactly what we're probably going to see this coming fall, because this goes back to the point that I was making right before our break, that we could imagine Trump having a lead on November 3rd because of these large volume of mail-in ballots that will break for Biden not having been counted. And we could try to, and we can imagine him insisting that that lead of November 3rd is really an indication that he's been reelected. And then as these mail-in ballots start being counted in the days and weeks after the election, and they shift towards Biden, and that's why it's called this blue shift, a term that I didn't come up with, but a colleague named Ned Foley did, that Trump simply says, well, this is what I've been predicting all along, that these mail-in ballots are going to be corrupt, they're going to have been rigged by the Democrats, and so this is just simply my prediction coming true. And what we need to do is we need to go with the November 3rd results that have me in the lead. And I could certainly imagine that claim gaining traction if the mail-in ballots become a source of a tremendous amount of kind of confusion in their counting. And it's certainly possible to imagine that. It's certainly possible to imagine a very disorderly counting process in the days and weeks after November 3rd. As we know, states such as your own, Wisconsin, and the other key swing states, Michigan, Pennsylvania, they don't even begin counting mail-in ballots until Election Day itself, whereas other states, Colorado, start counting them basically the moment that they arrive. And that means that there are going to be delays. The delays are going to be exacerbated by litigation. There's absolutely no doubt that Trump will be sending out legal teams to challenge the mail-in ballots, arguing that they haven't been submitted in timely fashion. And again, we combine that with what we've said about the USPS. It's also very possible that some of these, or even a large volume of mail-in ballots, are going to miss the submission deadlines. And all this kind of makes for a disorderly counting process, which I think will break to Trump's favor, because I think it will let him keep repeating his insistence that we have to go with the November 3rd results and that the mail-in ballots are unreliable.
The insistence that the system is rigged, the tweets that come frequently, is that throwing the system into chaos that you see?
For sure. We've actually seen that a very substantial percentage of Republican voters now agree with the president and doubt the integrity of mail-in ballots. And in fact, we've even seen quite remarkably these demonstrative protests among Trump supporters against mail-in ballots taking the form of gathering their mail-in ballots and burning them. Again, kind of burning them in a kind of demonstrative expression of support for the president's claims that this is an unreliable form of voting.
Amherst legal scholar Lawrence Douglas is our guide to our political climate, a looming constitutional crisis that he sees as a threat to our democracy. What do you want to know about what the U.S. Constitution calls for in disputed elections? How much faith do you have in our electoral system? Are you worried about systems in place for mail-in ballots? 800-642-1234. Back on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking with a legal scholar who ponders what might happen if President Trump refuses to accept the results of the November 3rd election. Questions to think about this hour. What happens if there isn't a decisive victory, regardless who wins? What does our Constitution and federal law say in order to secure the peaceful transition of power? Can our country withstand the constitutional chaos of a contested election or an undecidable one? Lawrence Douglas thinks about this as a law professor at Amherst College. His new book is called Will He Go? Trump and the Looming Election Meltdown in 2020. He stays with us for the hour. Let's go back to the phones now with Cyril in Madison to start us off. Hi, Cyril.
Hello, hello.
Hello.
One thing I wanted to bring up, given the recent history in Wisconsin of our legislature after the election of a Democrat for governor, is there any chance, or would there be a chance, that if Biden were to win the election, the Congress, being a lame duck, would enact a bunch of legislation or rulemaking that would impede Biden's ability to govern, just like Wisconsin's legislature did for our governor and attorney general?
Cyril, thank you for that question. What do you make of that scenario, Lawrence? And Cyril, you know, talking about the Wisconsin laws that came in place soon after Governor Evers came into power.
Right. Well, I don't think we need to worry about something similar happening on the federal level to Biden that happened to Evers. Because, of course, remember, our government on the federal level is divided. Congress is divided between, a Senate controlled by Republicans and the House controlled by Democrats. And in order to really create some kind of limits on executive power, you would obviously need some kind of bicameral support. The other thing is also that's worthwhile pointing out is, you know, a lot of the powers of the executive branch derive not from Congress themselves. They derive directly from Article 2 of the Constitution. So, excuse me. So I don't think we really need to worry about that all that much. But actually, going back to Cyril's point, I mean, I think Cyril brings up an interesting point about what can happen in Wisconsin itself. Because one of the things that we could imagine happening is if it is the case that in your state, Trump does enjoy an early lead, and if it's the case that it takes really weeks to figure out that Biden has won Wisconsin, it's not inconceivable to imagine a situation in which the Republican controlled state legislature in your state would try to certify Trump as having won the state, and that your governor Evers would then try to certify Biden is having won the state.
Oh, and suddenly you have two different tracks here on certifying the results of the election, one being the state legislature and one being from the governor's office.
Exactly. And again, if you kind of think of this as kind of like, well, how on earth could that happen? Well, it has happened. It's happened in American history. It happened, you know, quite catastrophically all the way back in 1876 in this Hayes-Tilden election. It actually happened even more recently, again, sometimes back, but in 1960 in the Kennedy-Nixon election, you had Hawaii submitting competing certificates. Now, if Wisconsin ends up being the swing state in the election, and you have competing electoral certificates as to who won the state, that really is a recipe for a nightmare.
Let's bring in Peter now in Mequon. Peter, hi, what are your insights?
I don't know about an insight, but a question. Are early voting ballots counted with the absentee ballots, the mail-in ones, or with the day of voting ballots? And then the comment is that I live in a fairly conservative community, but an awful lot of the people who voted for Trump last time do not have confidence in him and have more confidence in the system itself.
So, and Peter, starting with that first question there, Lawrence, as to when ballots are counted.
So I think the question that Peter is asking is whether early ballot, that people who just vote early, does that get counted with the mail-ins or does that get counted on the day of election? And again, part of that depends a little bit on states. I mean, mm-hmm. one of the things that we also have to recall is we really don't have a federalized system of elections. It's not as if we have federal law that says when states need to receive mail-in ballots by, when they need to start the count of mail-in ballots by. So it depends from state to state, at least where I live out in Massachusetts. The early votes do get counted along with the regular votes that are the in-person ballots that are cast on November 3rd. And I'm not exactly sure how things work in Wisconsin because, again, things do vary from state to state. And then I suppose the other thing that Peter mentioned was the fact that you have Trump voters who have lost faith in the president and have faith in the system. And I think that, of course, is a reassuring thing to hear, because I do think that Trump's opportunities to create electoral chaos this fall will be checked if he loses decisively. And again, by losing decisively, obviously, we're not simply talking about the popular vote. He lost pretty decisively in 2016. We're talking about in the Electoral College, and we're really talking about also the votes in swing states. If he loses decisively in states such as Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, then I think his opportunities to really create constitutional chaos are going to be checked.
The Assistant Secretary at the Department of Health and Human Services, Michael Caputo, has been in the news recently. You know, he said that Biden will be the one who refuses to concede the election. Caputo said when President Trump refuses to stand down at the inauguration, the shooting will begin. Are we at a point when our elections could take a violent turn?
It really was an astonishing statement that this Assistant Secretary for Public Affairs and DHS had issued. It was really quite astonishing. You know, just as, again, as a matter of speculation, is it possible that we could see some civil unrest and some ugly scenes on the streets of the United States in the weeks after this election? You know, unfortunately, I think it is possible. I mean, we've obviously seen some very distressing scenes over the summer and now into the early weeks of the fall. And, you know, we know that, you know, tens of millions of Trump supporters are heavily armed. And basically, if you have members of the administration saying that an act of an electoral defiance on Trump's part is really an act of preserving our democracy, if his supporters believe that, then, you know, they could see themselves fighting in defense of democratic institutions, not in an act of usurpation against them.
But how do you, how do you know that President Trump supporters are heavily armed?
I think we have statistics that suggest that. I mean, obviously, the American, I mean, I should mention that the Americans overall are heavily armed. I mean, we have over 300 million guns in the United States. And we've also seen, you know, disturbing, at least to my mind, disturbing scenes in which Trump supporters, when they engage in protests, they come very heavily armed. They're carrying automatic weapons. Not to say that they're necessarily using automatic weapons. So, of course, we saw one instance in which a Trump supporter did use automatic weapons and allegedly murdered two people. But, you know, these are very disturbing scenes to see people engaged in protests armed to the T. And it's very easy to imagine a tipping point in which heavily armed people end up using their arms, perhaps in a mistaken mistaken exercise of self-defense.
Lawrence Douglas is the author of the book Willie Go. It's a book that's examining what might happen if President Trump disputes the 2020 election. Let's take another call. Alan is with us in Augusta. Hi, Alan.
Hi. I was going to say, a friend and I had discussed the Electoral College. I ignorantly said that it needed to be abolished, especially for the way the last election went. But my friend said that, yeah, he believed that the Electoral College was flawed and that the way we need to adjust it is that instead of it being that a person wins by 1 point, they get all, pretty much a winner take all, that it should be like, what is it, Maryland or Maine, where your Electoral College votes are split up by the percentage of the win. So if a state's got three votes and a person wins 66%, well, then they get two votes, the other one gets one instead of winner take all. And the big reason he said that the Electoral College was important, because if you didn't have the Electoral College, pretty much New York State and California would choose our president, since they're the two most populated states in the country, and would pretty much leave the rest and the middle of the country out of the election.
Alan, thanks. Lawrence, what do you see here that Alan lays out in this?
So just to somewhat correct the picture that Alan was presenting. So there are two states right now, Nebraska and Maine, which actually award Electoral College votes not on the basis of the statewide winner, but on the basis of the winner of each district in the state. And that system, some people think, would be a more democratic system if all states adopted a district-wide winner approach rather than a statewide winner approach. But of course, that system would only be more democratic if these districts were drawn on coherent democratic lines. But actually what we know in this country, unfortunately, is that gerrymandering has very dramatically deformed the integrity of a lot of electoral districts. So I think, unfortunately, moving to this district-wide model actually would not lead us to more democratic results.
We'll be back in just a moment. More conversation with Lawrence Douglas here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with Amherst College Law Professor Lawrence Douglas. We've been discussing how to safeguard our election system and ensure the integrity of the outcome, as President Trump has tweeted about a rigged election, about fraudulent mail-in ballots, about a deep state plot. What happens if President Trump is unwilling to accept the election results? 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Jay now in Two Rivers. Hi, Jay.
Good morning, Mr. Douglas. I've got three concerns, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are. The first is, I'd be surprised if President Trump doesn't create a turmoil if he does not win the election. And number two, if he does concede, I can only imagine that it may be a very messy transition, unlike historic transitions, almost like a spoiled child breaking all his toys. And number three is, if there is a problem with our election, I wonder what effect that might have on the stock market. Thank you.
All right, Jay. So Jay laying out several points here, and one being, how might this impact, this election affect our economy on the market? That is his last point.
You know, I wish I had a better insight into that, Kate. Then I probably would know what to do with my own investments. I would imagine that, you know, political turmoil is never a particularly good thing for stocks. But I'm afraid that we should probably turn the question over to our financial advisors rather than leaving it to a legal scholar. I think my guess is probably as good as yours. And probably the best thing I could say is turmoil. Markets don't like chaos.
Well, turmoil and, as he said, messy transitions, you know, you're imagining some worst case scenarios here about our democracy. Is there anything that is giving you hope that our democracy will endure?
Certainly. I mean, we obviously have, you know, very strong institutions. I mean, the fact of the matter is, though, when it does come to the peaceful succession of power, one thing that I think we can fairly say is it's not so much that our system of constitutional and federal law secure the peaceful succession of power. They kind of presuppose it. They kind of assume that it's going to happen. They assume that the people in higher office are acting in good faith and will be respecting the process itself. And so, again, unfortunately, our present incumbent is somewhat of a wild card. But I do, you know, as I mentioned earlier, you know, I do think if he loses very decisively, then his opportunities to create a real kind of constitutional chaos will be severely limited. Now, that's not to say that he's going to gracefully concede. I don't imagine Trump gracefully conceding under any circumstances. I think no matter what happens, even if he's beaten very, very decisively, he'll still continue to insist that his defeat was the result of fraud, deep state conspiracies. But I still think he'll be forced to at least submit to the reality of defeat. That is, he'll realize that any kind of additional challenges are going to be futile. And in that sense, I do, you know, hope that we do see a peaceful succession of power. Now, it might again be somewhat messy, as Jay suggested, but I think one of the important things about having a Biden enter higher office is that Biden has a tremendous amount of experience within the executive branch, has a tremendous a number of contacts with people who will be able to create a smooth transition, even if the members of the Trump team tried to, in a sense, gum up the works.
Let's bring in Marcus now in Milwaukee. Good morning, Marcus.
Good morning. So I feel like we've already been at this point before and more recently than what we've discussed so far. With Richard Nixon, there was an order that was sent out because they were afraid he was going to stay in office. And so to the Navy and the Marines, it was different. But essentially, it said ignore all orders from high hat or ignore all orders from top hat. So it stopped him from being able to activate the Marines, the National Guard, whatever. And that helped maintain order. The other one is that we had with the Al Gore, George W. Bush in Florida with the hanging chads and Jeb Bush, and that was resolved through the Supreme Court. We do have mechanisms to resolve these things. We need to just stay calm and just trust in our fellow Americans.
Well, Marcus, thanks. Let's talk about that closely contested presidential election of the 2000 race between Al Gore and George W. Bush. The outcome came down to who would win Florida, and it was just hundreds of votes in that recount. They were, as Marcus said, hanging chads. Remind us what happened here.
So Marcus actually made a claim, which I think is important for us to look at. So Marcus said, well, the Supreme Court back in 2000 intervened basically to end that electoral dispute. And recall, everything, as you said, Kate, was turning on the results in Florida. The margin of victory for Bush ended up being kind of improbably tiny.
Mm-hmm.
It was 537 votes. And the Supreme Court, 35 days after the United States went to the polls, they basically ended the Florida recount. And as Marcus points out, you know, a lot of Americans believe that even if the Supreme Court's decision might have been somewhat partisan, even if it was probably not the best reasoned decision by the Supreme Court, it was necessary to bring closure to that electoral dispute. But here's where I think Marcus is maybe not entirely correct, because I don't think it was the Supreme Court which ended that dispute. I think it was Al Gore. Because it was Gore who very graciously conceded on the day after the court rendered its decision. And there are many people within his legal team, there are many Democratic lawmakers who were urging Gore to continue to continue the fight. And he could have. And if you slot a Donald Trump into the position of Al Gore in 2000, there is no doubt that we would have been in the midst of a real dramatic electoral meltdown. So I don't think it's fair to say that, well, we can safely assume that institutions like the Supreme Court can save us from a true electoral meltdown. I really don't think that's the case if you have a president who's willing to play constitutional brinkmanship, as this one seems to be willing to do.
Let's bring in Scott now on Alaska. Hi, Scott.
Hi, how are you today?
Doing well. Go ahead.
I am just wondering, say it is a wide margin and our current president is victorious. I have recently heard a statement from Hillary Clinton saying that there absolutely should be no way that Biden should concede this election. Absolutely no way. Just a few days ago, it was... I mean, and this is recent. Are you aware of these quotes from Ms. Clinton or no?
And this quote from the Showtime, The Circus, which the clip was released Tuesday, and it is Joe Biden should not concede under any circumstances because I think this is going to drag out. And eventually, I do believe he will win if we don't give an inch. It goes on from there. Lawrence?
Yeah, so again, I think it's very important. This is, again, one of the unfortunate things that we live in, you know, this media environment in which quotes are misstated and then go viral. So what Hillary Clinton was saying is that he should not concede if he is trailing on November 3rd. And I think she was simply trying to remind the nation that we might not know the results of the election until days or even weeks after November 3rd. So she wasn't engaged. She wasn't recommending that Biden engage in electoral defiance if at the end of the day he's lost the election. She's simply urging him to do what I think would be the proper thing to do, which is to wait until all votes are counted. And I think that is a very good recommendation for all of us to heed.
Lawrence, thank you for joining us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure for talking with you, Kate. Really, thanks so much for the invitation.
Lawrence Douglas is a law professor at Amherst College in Massachusetts. He's the author of 7 books, including his latest. It's called Will He Go? Trump and the Looming Election Meltdown in 2020. Coming up, it is 1 A. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.